web services.
Welcome to the Cloud or Not podcast. We are your hosts, Andreas and
Michael Wittig. We have been building on AWS since 2009. Follow along as we develop products like BucketDB, Marbot, HyperEnv, and learn from our practice. This is episode number 85, and we are recording this on February the 1st in 2024. In case you're watching this live on YouTube or LinkedIn, feel free to ask your questions directly in the comments, and we will answer them during or at the end of the show. So, Andreas, we have a new blog post that you wrote with a interesting finding. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me start with that. So actually, it all started with I was looking into writing an IAM policy for granting access to KMS. So the idea was that Marbot, our AWS monitoring solution, creates a KMS key, and so I needed to write an IAM policy for that. And from that, I really I found so much that I didn't know about KMS and IAM policies and so on. And I ended up with the following. So, Michael, KMS comes with two types of keys, customer-managed keys and the built-in default keys. Do you know the difference between those two key types?
So I think the major difference is that the key policy is only changeable for the customer managed ones, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So I think that's the main difference. So with customer managed keys, you can also bring your own key materials, but I never fully understood why this is important, because you're storing the key material on AWS anyways. So I think it's just if you need control over how this key material was created, that's probably the reason for that. But yeah, the biggest difference is you can define key policies for your customer managed KMS keys, and those key policies are kind of interesting because there are other resource based policies on AWS. So there are, for example, for an S3 bucket, it's a very popular probably use case for resource policies. So you can attach a bucket policy to a bucket and then basically grant access to S3 objects in the bucket, for example, using the key policy. And usually with all resource-based policies, you either grant access through the resource policy or through an identity policy that is attached to an IAM use or IAM role. But with a KMS keys, this is different. So there, by default, you have to grant both the access in the key policy as well as in the IAM policy, identity policy attached to someone. And the problem with that is, because of this, it's possible that you lock yourself out of the key when modifying the key policy accidentally. Or if you, for example, delete the IAM users or something referenced in there. And then the question is, how can you recover from such a key policy? And I was thinking about that. So actually, if you change the key policy, you can modify the key policy in a way that no one can access the key anymore. So it's basically just the same as deleting the key, right? But there is no mechanism. So for deleting keys, there's a mechanism in AWS that says you can schedule the deletion of a key, but it takes 7 to 30 days until the key then gets deleted. But you can just change the key policy right away and it's in effect immediately. So I was thinking about a ransomware kind of attacks using key policies and stuff like that. And I was sharing that on LinkedIn and someone wrote, oh, that's not an issue. You can ask AWS support to reset the key policy if you accidentally have locked out yourself from that. And I said, I cannot believe that this is possible. It's not possible that the human being at AWS is possible to modify my key policy to grant me access to this, because that makes the whole key policy kind of useless, right? So I was digging a little into that. And what I find out that if you specify a key policy, it's actually possible to, to do privilege escalation so that you are able to change the key policy, even though the key policy says you are not allowed to do so. So that is what I actually found out. Michael, are you interested in how that works?
Yes, I am.
Did I get your attention already? Okay. So it's not really a hack or a security vulnerability. So the procedure is even documented in the AWS documentation. So I didn't know that, but now I know, and you know as well. So how does it work? So let's say we have a key policy attached to a key user, and the only one that is allowed to administer the key is a user, an IAM user called Bob. And this user wants to make sure no one else can modify the key because it's a very sensitive key. You use it to encrypt very sensitive data and you don't want to others to delete it and so on. So here's Bob with a key policy that only grants Bob access, administrator access to the key. But now, the example goes like that. So Alice has also access to the AWS account. And she, by the way, she has administrator access to the account, or almost administrator access to the account. We will see why this is important later. But because of the key policy, she does not have access to the KMS key. She cannot administer that. Yeah, so this is blocked by the key policy, actually. And so the question is, how can Alice now get access to the key, even if she is not allowed because of the key policy? And it works like that. So first, Alice deletes the IAM user Bob. So this results in a key policy attached to the KMS key that grants no one access to the key anymore. So basically, if Alice deletes all IAM users or IAM roles that are attached or referenced in the key policy, then no one can edit the key anymore. And now Alice opens an AWS support ticket and asks AWS support for help to reset the key policy because no one is able to change it anymore, the key. And AWS support says, oh, fine, not a problem. We will do so for you. Please create a new IAM user with a specific name. And then we will call you and you have to tell us, basically we verify that you are the right person to do such a key reset by calling you later. Okay. Alice now updates the telephone number, the phone number in the AWS account settings, which means AWS support will now call Alice. And Alice answers the phone and says, oh, it's fine. You can reset the key policy and grant the user that I created access to the key. And AWS support will do so. So now Alice has access to a key that she formerly didn't have any access to because the key policy that Bob specified. So that is basically how you can rework the key policy by opening a ticket to AWS support. So what's the trick? So when does this scenario work? It doesn't work in all scenarios. So it's important that Alice is able to delete all the users and all the roles that are referenced in the key policy. Otherwise, the whole thing doesn't work. Of course, Alice needs to be needs to be able to update the phone number of the account. And also, it's important that the key policy does not grant access to IAM in general. So you basically can use a specific policy to just basically do not use this key policy, grant the access management to IAM or hand over the access management to IAM. And if that's in the key policy, then the whole thing doesn't work as well. But if you use key policies in the, I would say, original way they were intended to probably, then this is possible if Alice is able to delete users and roles. So this was kind of scary to find that out, that is working, because actually I wouldn't expect that a support engineer or whoever on AWS side is able to reset key policies manually. And also the approval process is actually calling a phone number somewhere in my AWS account. So I find that really a little scary. And to me, it doesn't seem to be very well thought through, actually. So the question is, how to deal with that, or how to mitigate that, or I don't know. So it's a little, let's say like that, it lowers my trust in KMS a lot. And as this is an important service for encryption, this is not really good news, in my opinion.
Yeah, I see interest. But I have one question, like, is it like the process that was started? Is this like, does this feel like something that is kind of automated? Because I was also wondering if the support engineer can, like, what allows them to trigger the process, right? I mean, it can be, is it your text and somehow they pass it and see it's a KMS key, a lockout problem, and then he's allowed to start the process? Or who authorizes support to change your policy, right? That's, do you get what I mean?
Yeah, so I'm not 100% sure, but I think it is. So the support checks whether you locked yourself out from the key policy. So that as soon as there is no other way to get access to the key without basically resetting the key policy, I think then they are allowed to start the process. That's what I think. I don't know 100%, but that's my assumption at least. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, Michael. So let's proceed with the next topic. So you have been working on something completely different and then got into thinking about AWS.
Yeah, that's right, Andreas. So I was like, as you know, we kind of like for a long time, like since 2009, more or less all our eggs are in the AWS platform basket, right? So we heavily rely on AWS doing the right things. And a couple of years ago, we started thinking, how could we make us a little less dependent on AWS and basically spread the risk a little bit? And so we decided that we want to start investigating other platforms. And what that basically led to last year, that we started using the Atlassian platform, and we created two products for that, Attachment AV for Jira and Attachment AV for Confluence, which is basically an antivirus, anti-malware solution for Jira and Confluence on the cloud. And what we also do what I'm also doing at the moment is, and I started that at the end of last year, is that we are looking into the Salesforce platform as well. And what I discovered while using both platforms from a developer perspective who develops apps for those platforms is that in both cases, you can integrate very nicely into their UI. So you can create an app for Atlassian, and you can create a user interface for that app that sits natively in the Jira or Confluence UI. So you don't really notice from the outside or from looking at it that this is not Jira anymore, it's your app basically, because it's on the same page and literally on the same page. So what I did last week is, for example, I added a configuration page for Confluence and Jira for our app, and it was first very simple to do, and it looks in the same way than the rest of the product, like the Jira Confluence product. So it's really easy and nice, and this led me, or this kind of once again asked, or basically once again, I was asking myself why AWS doesn't allow us to customize their UI a little bit. So what I was thinking of is, for example, they now have this new homepage where they have widgets. So why is it not possible to add custom widgets, for example, to the homepage? I mean, they have the AWS Marketplace, they could use the AWS Marketplace for distribution. That could be one integration point. You could also just add another page like an S3 or EC2 service. You could add another page in the main navigation bar. Or even, I mean, more work, but even more integrated, you could, for example, say, okay, I want to add my custom action whenever an EC2 instance is selected. So when you click on the EC2 instance, then there is an actions drop down, and there you could add your own entry. And if you click that, your own custom action is executed. So this could be, I think, a rich experience for all the use cases that AWS does not cover. And as we all know, AWS is not really interested in the details. So they lack a lot of capabilities. that many people want, and so they could just build their own capabilities. But that's not possible at the moment, and I really don't understand why. And I'm asking that for a couple of years, because it seems to be so kind of straightforward to do that for AWS, to allow partners to extend their UI, to help them kind of to implement all the small use cases that they are not interested in, but partners might be. So that was kind of my idea, and yeah, I don't know if that makes any sense, Andreas.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's really interesting. So AWS puts a lot of effort into the AWS marketplace those days. So if you scroll, for example, through the AWS news, you will find new features that they release constantly, and they're, of course, putting a lot of effort in their partner program because it helps them to grow their business. So it's very interesting why all those solutions in the AWS marketplace don't have any way to integrate into the AWS management console. And they have to build their own API, their own UIs, and it's always a challenge because of the things like user access management, stuff like that. So yeah, it would be so easy to integrate it into their UI and have a building block system like others have. Yeah, so very interesting why this is not possible at all. Maybe we'll see something like that in the future. That would be really great. Okay. So Michael, I have something. I had a new idea for the Cloud or Not podcast, and that's, we will try it first time today. So my idea is that we go over some of the AWS news from the past 14 days since our last recording, and I will basically update you with some of the news that I was thinking could interest you. I'm reading them to you, and then you can basically react to them and tell me what you think. So just answer quickly the first thoughts that come to your mind when going over that news item. Okay. So the first one is AWS Code Build announces support for reserved capacity. So basically the idea is, so Code Build, a CI/CD service by AWS, basically formally when you had a job to run there, it took a little, I don't know, a minute or something before the job started because it was just scheduled among their fleet of servers somewhere. And now what you can basically have is reserved capacity, which means there is a machine running 24/7 for you and your jobs start immediately on that machine. So this is basically the new feature that is out now. So what do you think about that?
I don't know if I need that. So I mean, the problem probably is the 24/7 part. So it seems to be like wasteful and therefore expensive, right? So, I mean, I don't need that 24/7. I just need it working hours.
Yeah.
But probably there's no controls around that. So you pay for the 24/7 thing. And
yeah, you could, I think you can automate something to have that. So they call it a fleet. So you can create it and delete it. So you could have, I think if that's not a feature yet, you can build a Lambda function or something to start it up or to delete it. You're paying for at a minimum for a full hour, and then I think per minute. So it would be possible to have it only during, I don't know, typical working hours or something. That should work in theory. I checked the costs. So the smallest available instance is a 2 vCPU, 3 GB memory one, which costs about $90 if you run it 24/7 for a month. So that's quite a lot. So yeah, I think you need to, it probably makes sense to shut it down if possible. I don't think there is a built-in way to do so, but you could do that maybe with a, I don't know, a Lambda function or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, my second thought basically is, like, after thinking about that for a while, I always wonder why they start to do things like that instead of just optimizing the startup time in the first place. But maybe they're out of ideas, right? So this is kind of the only, or they are out of, they need some money. So that could also be
the
point. I don't know.
It's also interesting because it kind of relates to our product HyperEnv for GitHub Actions. And there, So I came from that approach as well. So in the beginning, my first implementations were around spinning up instances and running multiple jobs on them, keeping them, scaling them automatically during work hours and so. But I find the approach to just spin up a machine when it's really needed much more convenient. And also you don't have isolated machines for every workload. You don't have to think about security issues for isolating your workloads and stuff like that. I have no idea how they do that actually. So I think it's probably, is it probably containers and Firecracker? I don't know. But that's probably their isolation layer they use here. Yeah. But that's what I think. It's so easy to just spin up EC2 machines when you need them. So why bother? And the 30 seconds or minute it takes until it starts the job, I don't know if that's really so important to optimize for that. But yeah. Okay. So the next one, Michael, this is something maybe I hope this brings something up in you. So Amazon ECS announces managed instance training. So I don't know if you remember back in the days when we tried to automate managing clusters of EC2 instances for ECS. So this was always so hard. We have CloudFormation templates. I think we had several implementations of that. So what to do when instance scale up and scale down, how to move containers to other machines before you terminate them, how to do rolling updates of an AMI and so on. And now, Michael, this feature is available as a built-in feature in ECS. Very cool. So now if you need to roll out a new AMI, ECS will, before that, shift the running containers on the machine to other instances in the cluster. So this is now a built-in feature in ECS. So I don't know how many years it took them to implement that, but here it is. And what do you think?
I think that's definitely a useful feature. The only problem is that now I'm not interested in it anymore because I'm not using ECS anymore.
Using EC2 with ECS? Yeah.
5 years too late, but still.
Yeah.
They're working on it, right?
Yeah. That's good. Yeah. So yeah, I think now it's completely, we have completely moved away from managing EC2 for ECS because it all runs on Fargate now.
In Fargate, yeah. So.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But yeah, here it goes. Okay. So the next one, Michael. So AWS announces higher read IOPS for Amazon Elastic File System. So again, they are increasing the throughput and now it delivers 40% higher read IOPS per file system. So what do you think about that announcement, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, that's always great. It works for all file systems, so you don't have to change anything or something. So it's just there. It's always great. I mean, that is always great. Yeah.
The interesting thing here is when they started with EFS, I think many of us tried it out and we all ran into issues with the performance of the file system. And over the years, I don't know, I haven't counted them, but there were at least 10 or so announcements that they improved performance significantly. So I really applaud them that they are investing into making the system faster and higher throughput, lower latency, and so on. I think around reInvent, they had announcement around the latency. So it's really cool that they are. It's a kind of a boring service, but an important one, especially for legacy systems that you want to migrate to AWS. So I'm happy to see that they are innovating and improving here. Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, Michael, the next one is another ECS announcement. So I don't know, the ECS team has woken up. So they shipped all their features 2 months after reInvent. So So here's another one. ECS introduces support for automatic traffic encryption with TLS certificates. So this uses the Service Connect feature, which is one of the many features you can build your service mesh in ECS. And you can now have that TLS encrypted with certificates managed by AWS. What do you think, Michael?
Yeah, so as you said, the only thing that is kind of confusing me is that there are so many options. But yeah, basically, if I have containers running and they want to talk to each other, this can now be encrypted automatically, which is great. But I think, as always, the problem with those kinds of encryption mechanisms that AWS builds is they do not work with the for free certificates, right? So there is a catch.
Yes. So how it works is, so first of all, Service Connect basically is using the proxy container, so to deploy the proxy container to all your tasks. And then I think it's, I don't know if it's using Envoy under the hood or something like that. And basically they build their own backend to manage those proxy settings and roll them out. And what they're now doing is they integrate with AWS Private CA, so the Private Certificate Authority. And so my first thinking was, oh, that's expensive, because I know that this can be very expensive, and I looked it up. So a Private CA costs you $400 per month. But the good news is there's now a new option. So things changed with Private CA as well, and they have now another offering for $50 per month, which gives you short-lived credentials. And this is exactly what you need here. So they even so the ECS team even recommends to use those short-lived certificates. So yeah, it costs you $50 to use those certificates for encrypting the traffic between your containers. So I think that's maybe fine. Okay, that's how it works. Okay, Michael. Let's move on to the next one. So this is more an enterprise feature. So Amazon Inspector now supports CIS benchmark assessments for operating systems in EC2 instances. What are your thoughts, right, Michael? But I think we have, so customers ask us about this hardening our instances with the CIS benchmark from time to time for Bucket AV. So I think it could help us actually to run those benchmarks, because I think before that there was a kind of an AWS-related benchmark only, and now we have the official one that probably the industry uses. So that makes maybe sense.
So So basically, I was just thinking about that. A couple of years ago for BucketAV, I looked into how we can make Amazon Linux comply with the CIS benchmark, because some customers were asking for that, and I was also looking for tools, and I think Inspector had some capabilities, but maybe they are now better or something. Yeah, that's okay. That's great for us, so we can just automatically run that, and whenever we violate something, we see it. The other problem with the CIS security benchmark thing for Amazon Linux is that, like, I can remember that I opened up the PDF and I started implementing it, but it really gets very, very, very... I mean, extensive. I basically... I stopped kind of looking at the PDF when they told me how to create partitions on my disk and all kinds of things. So it's from a world where machines were running for 10 years or so. It's not auto scaling or anything like that, right? I mean, I don't know if they have updated that. So I hope, because otherwise I will still not implement all their checks, because they don't make sense.
Yeah, but I think it's also from a world where you had multiple workloads running on the same machine. That's something we probably usually do not do anymore. So a lot of those things are probably coming from that. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, but it's interesting. So I will probably test it out. So that's the first one that I will test. Yeah.
Okay. Michael, the next one is Amazon EKS now supports Kubernetes version 1.29. What do you think?
I don't have any opinion on that, Andreas.
You don't have any opinion. You're not using EKS at all. I found one interesting. So one thing came to mind. So first of all, I've seen some people writing, oh, I'm now updating all my clusters to version 1.29. So I thought, oh, crazy. This is something you have to do if you're using EKS. You have to upgrade your clusters from time to time and schedule a maintenance window and stuff like that and see if it works or not, and test it in test environments first and in production. So a lot to do. When you compare it with ECS. And then the other thing I was looking up is, so this is really, so the Kubernetes release was released on January the 17th. So they are really close to the releases of the open source software. So I remember back in the days, it took them a month to get out with the release on AKS after Kubernetes published it. So I think that's good news for all of you who are using AKS. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. One more thing, Michael. This is the last one for this show. Provision capacity for API limits are now available in Amazon Cognito. And the thing is here that you can now increase the built-in quotas for the API, so the requests per second that you can do for Cognito. If you have a huge workload, you can now increase those quotas. So this is the news here. Any thoughts?
All right. That's great. So my thought is that someone at AWS has probably envisioned a provision capacity strategy, Andreas. Yeah, because now in every item here, I see provision capacity. So they are probably going to add provision capacity everywhere.
Do you
so
think
it's a new
they
feature?
Don't. Yeah, I didn't understand the pricing model completely. I think you have to pay for modifying the quota as well. So I didn't really understand it. So I've seen that the Burning Monk has been writing about it. So you check out his blog post. He was complaining about it. So I looked it up. So the quotas are quite high. So you can user authentication. The default is 120 requests per second. Mm-hmm. So I think you're not getting into those areas with most of the applications that you're building out there. But for those who do, there's now possibility to increase that, costing you probably an arm and a leg, but it's at least possible. And I think it's important to, many times when you had to make a decision which service we can use or not, it's important that you have the possibility to grow, because if you have services from AWS where it's just not impossible to increase the quota, you're kind of stuck using it because you then have to migrate away to a complete other service in the future. So you're not starting with it anyway. So I think that's good news for Cognito. So a little progress is is happening with Cognito. So we had an announcement regarding, I think, the groups or something, and now we have another one. So someone started picking up the backlog on the Cognito service. That's maybe also great. Let's see.
The most important item they found was someone needs provision capacity. Okay, let's do that.
I don't know. Maybe this was the highest thing on the list. I don't know.
Not sure.
Maybe the one you can increase revenue the most. Okay, Michael. So that's it. That's it for today. We'll be back soon. Subscribe to our newsletter, podcast, or the YouTube channel to make sure you're not missing the upcoming episodes. And we're also looking forward to your feedback. hello@cloudonaut.io or find us on LinkedIn and Mastodon. Again, as always, you will find all the links in the show notes and the video description. So thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.